So we appreciate your coming out to the Jerome Stern Distinguished Writers Series.
And here to introduce our visiting speaker is Jen Adams.
Hi. It gives me enormous pleasure tonight to introduce Deborah Monroe to the Warehouse as part of the Jerome N. Stern Distinguished Writers Series. A two-time nominee for the National Book Award, Deborah Monroe is the author of two memoirs, two novels, and two short story collections, one of which, The Source of Trouble, won the Flannery O'Connor Award for Short Fiction. Born in Aberdeen, South Dakota, and raised in Spooner, Wisconsin, Monroe received her PhD from the University of Utah and has taught at UNC Greensboro. Monroe currently teaches at the MFA program at Texas State University, San Marcos, where she received the Presidential Award for Excellence in Teaching in 2012. Her writing is regularly featured in the New York Times and Salon. And her stories and Best American Cited essays have been widely published in journals such as the New England Review, Kalalu, the Southern Review, Prairie Schooner, and the American Scholar. Ron Carlson has called Monroe a fierce writer. John Dufresne has compared her masterful storytelling to Chekhov. Antonia Nelson has praised, I'm sorry about the police here. I'll just pause. Let them pass. Okay. Antonia Nelson has praised Monroe's characters' hard edges, dark humor, and big hearts. And Philip Lopate has marveled at Monroe's consummate control and aphoristic wit. Not to be outdone, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution has compared Monroe's persona narrators to Lucinda Williams and Wonder Woman. So I can't imagine a cooler hybrid than that. Indeed, Monroe's writing is soulful and heroic, brilliant and beautiful, wise and insightful, fearlessly vulnerable. She writes lyrically and unflinchingly about love, ambition, race, class, marriage, domestic violence, sexual desire, and motherhood. Monroe's articulation of motherhood in her brilliant 2010 memoir, On the Outskirts of Normal, held me rapt and should be required reading for anyone considering parenthood or in the throes of it. Monroe writes about holding her baby daughter in her arms for the first time. I felt tremulous and awestruck at the wrenching elation of loving a child, letting my heart roam around the risky world. Speaking as a parent, I can't imagine a more perfect translation. Monroe's most recent memoir, My Unsentimental Education, was lauded in a 4-star review by the San Francisco Book Review for its wit, humor, and raw, unapologetic tone. Rosalind Brown concurred, saying that Deborah Monroe is a terrifically acute observer of the two worlds of women, her mother's generation, corseted in sexual and familial constraints, her own, in which she gathers lovers and addresses that shift with the wind. She is able, in other words, to make just as many mistakes, only different ones. My Unsentimental Education is very funny, not least at the author's own expense, and it raises a dozen potent questions about what has changed for a generation of women not so much disillusioned as unillusioned about what it means to live like a man. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Deborah Monroe.
So I have this water, and I'm going to have to go like this. All right, so I can't see you at all, so maybe that's good. I mean, you know, for nerves, not because you don't look good. Okay, so I started out as a poet, and how is this? Is that good? I started out as a poet, but had only published poems, and then I started writing. They were getting longer and longer and more narrative. And then I started writing fiction. And I had published 4 books of fiction, and I teach fiction and read it for a living. So I started writing nonfiction, reading it and writing it to play hooky from my day job. And now I don't hear the fictional voice in my head anymore. And my first book of nonfiction, On the Outskirts of Normal, which is nominally about being the white single mother of a black child in a small, hick Texas town. But it's really, you know, about my life and, you know, looking at all of your mistakes and errors. But at least it had that elevator pitch, and at first people were really, in New York, were really excited about it, you know, like, holy cow. But then they'd read it and they were like, but we really wanted it to have, like, you know, resolution, like The Blind Side. And I was like, you mean like I wiped out racism? And they would be like, and I'm like, well, I don't work in the genre of fantasy, but anyway. But at least with that book, you could say in a sentence, white woman, black child, small Texas town. But with this book, to do the one sentence pitch, I needed subordinate clauses. So I'll just try to, it's really about jumping social classes, if you know what I mean. Is there anybody here who was like, I can't see anybody, so this is freaking me out. But was there anybody here who was like raised working class and then felt weird when they went to school? Just me? Oh, okay, that's three of us. But it's really weird because you can't go home, you fit nowhere. You feel weird when you're out in public. So it's about social class jumping, and it's also very much about gender, or like how the Horatio Alger story plays out a little differently for women, especially during that first awkward era just after the feminist movement. And one review said that I grew up with June Cleaver on one shoulder and Gloria Steinem on the other, but I mean, that's kind of putting it in. I mean, it was a very working class June Cleaver, and I saw Gloria Steinem on TV when I was 10, and they called them bra burners. And the only other thing I wanted to say, too, is that Spooner, Wisconsin, you might need to know. Do you know where, like, okay, here's Wisconsin, and here's Milwaukee and Madison, like, here's Spooner? And it had population 2000, and it had two whorehouses and 18 bars on Main Street and one bank and one drugstore. And I just grew up with it, and we thought it was normal. I mean, really, we walked past the, they had strippers in the daytime, and so, like, with windows to the street, so you could, like, look in, and we would, and then they'd be like, kids, go, you know, so, but the book, flap copy, you know, this stuff, it says that I had moved from a small town surrounded by farms, bars, and strip joints, but at night I kept dating what the book politely calls blue-collar men, which is a real insult to blue-collar men, because basically I dated unemployed guys or guys who made their living in the illegal economy. And this went on a really long time. I mean, I was well into my 40s before I'd, like, dated people who didn't sell drugs or play in bands. Okay, so, all right, everybody good? All right, I'm going to read a little bit from the beginning, like when I'm really young, and then I'm going to skip ahead and read like three pages from when I'm a little older, okay? I'm sorry. It's this light. All right, and it's kind of like, I guess, is this good? Okay, I'm sorry. That light is very, like it's hard to see. So, okay. I dove deep into the fracas of high school, including kids who lived in town, also kids who rode the bus and smelled like barn, where my sister was a cheerleader and rodeo royalty, doubling as Miss Spooner and her attendants. She followed rules. On weekends, she drank and made out because these were rules. So was not getting caught. I objected to not getting caught. Over the summer, I'd read The Autobiography of Malcolm X, My Darling, My Hamburger, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Catcher in the Rye, Mr. and Mrs. Bojo Jones. The national zeitgeist, disestablishmentarianism, had trickled down by way of the paperback book rack at Rexall Drug. I'd get grounded, then sprung, then grounded. My parents didn't object to jocks, but I knew them as mean, then friendly after dark, trying to take my clothes off. Stoners were called heads. He has faraway eyes, my mother said about a head whose mother had died. He has a sickly sweet odor like a spice rack, she said about another.
She was paraphrasing the warning signs your child might be on drugs. I didn't smoke pot, but I didn't mind if people did. I made out with heads, practicing kissing. Like my sister and my parents, I knocked back alcohol. Drinking erased anxiety and social distinctions. My dad drank with people who were fun but didn't have work ethic. Heads and jocks drank together in hunting camps with bunk rooms, squeaky bed springs, soft moans. Then I met a man at the fair. He was short with a grown-up's head and shoulders. If he'd been taller, he'd have been uninterested in a 14-year-old waiting to ride the Rocco Plains. He worked for the phone company, repairing connections in the office, in people's houses, on top of tall poles. I noted with a sense of awe for his vocation as I rode down highways in my mother's car. He lived on his parents' farm because his dad had a bad heart. Meanwhile, my sister was pre-engaged, a friendship ring with a diamond chipped. This thrilled my taskmaster grandmother, who'd been single and considered a spinster until she was 20. My unhappy, wandering grandmother, who was 16 when she married for the first time, 60 when she married the widower who'd advertised for a wife. I'll call my elfin, muscled boyfriend Rodney V. Meadow, a synonym for his real name. V stands for verdant, life teemed with allegory. On Saturday, I'd go to dinner with Rodney V. Meadow, who bought buy one, get one free coupons to supper clubs, restaurants deep in the woods. People arrived by snowmobile or in cars with tires wrapped in chains. After dinner, we made out in his truck. I wondered, were sperm airborne? What did vigorous swimming mean? I fell ill wondering. My mother, who bought sanitary napkins in bulk, said, "You're moody because your period is late." One night in my bedroom, my alarm clock ticked on. I gave up on biology and focused on plot, foreshadowing, and upshot. In our living room, with its imitation brass lamps aglow, pledge-polished furniture gleaming, my mother's face would crumple. It had crumpled a few weeks earlier when one of my classmates got out of a car at school wearing a maternity dress hemmed as a mini. My dad and I would pour brandy with one hand. My dad would pour brandy with one hand, hold his other over his heart as he did when he told you he was hurt, often, or grateful, rarely. I'd cook for Rodney V. Meadow when he came in from the phone company, I realized. After my baby became a child, I'd serve cupcakes at the elementary school. Outside, dawn crept over snow-covered houses, and I sneaked to the phone in the basement to call Rodney and tell him we were getting married. The moving around must have released muscles because I was instantly not pregnant. When I talked to him that weekend, he explained I couldn't have been pregnant because we hadn't had sex. He knew because he and his dad sometimes hired a bull and watched it work. He'd had sex himself in the past. He'd like to again, he added. I couldn't trust myself not to, I knew. And I didn't want to squander another series of days and nights worrying about how I'd feel moving to a squat house with hodgepodge furniture, or wheeling my baby through Super Value as I bought meat, eggs, Comet, Gerber products, Windex. In 1974, in Massachusetts and Wisconsin, the pill was newly legal for single women. I'd read this in Time magazine. The decision about minors was pending. I forged a "Please excuse Debbie from school" note, walked to a phone booth and called every doctor in the greater Spooner area. Receptionists would say the doctor was patient, so I'd blurt, "Would he prescribe the pill to a 17-year-old without parental consent?" Most hung up. One said, "You should pray." Anonymous, I kept dialing. Then a receptionist said, "Honey, Dr. X won't, but if you call Dr. Y in Shell Lake, he will." I forged another note, and Rodney took the afternoon off to drive me to Shell Lake, where Dr. Y asked my real age. I was 15. I said 16. The doctor seemed not to believe this either, but gave me a year's supply of pills Rodney stored in his tool locker. Soon, my parents let me spend weekends in the Meadows spare bedroom because my mother felt farm chores were salutary. Or she was glad I'd stopped dating heads. One day I drove the tractor while everyone loaded hay. Rodney's father clutched his chest and turned purple when, after he'd expressed doubt that I was the right person to drive a tractor, I took a corner too sharp. The tractor started tipping, one side of the hay wagon climbing up a big wheel, spinning in midair. Rodney sprinted across the field, leapt to the top of the tractor, reversed it. The tractor righted itself. The hay wagon rolled back down, its axle and my life saved. That night, Rodney's mother told me that no one starts out as an expert. We watched the Carol Burnett show, and she taught me to embroider pillow slips. My wandering grandmother embroidered. The next time I saw her, I showed her my work. She said my knots on the backside were messy, that the back should look as good as the front. I embroidered on, piling up pillow slips and towels, though, as my mother noted, they'd look ragged after one time through the spin cycle. One night, Rodney and I sat staring at cattails in a shallow lake, the radio tuned up to a top 40 station hundreds of miles away. For a moment, John Denver's song about his ex-wife seemed like poetry. Reasonable poetry for a man who hunted and fished, I thought, eyeing Rodney. Night in the forest, mountains in springtime. Rodney could discuss these. Maybe they filled up his senses. But he couldn't take the next step and equate bliss in the woods with bliss he felt spending time with me. Could I live the rest of my life never hearing words like these said to me? I couldn't. But a day later, ironing my father's shirts, I turned sensible. Poetry was extravagance, I decided. Everyone has longings. During the short, dark days of winter, Rodney must have had his longings because he'd go to the bar after work and come to pick me up late and drunk. It would take me ages to forgive this, though my sister's boyfriend did it too, and my dad missed every second or third dinner the same way, and my gambling grandfather used to leave my taskmaster grandmother for weeks. Once my mother stared at me sitting cross-legged on the console stereo, a coffin-shaped box with a turntable inside, as I stared out the window waiting for Rodney's truck. She said, "That's marriage for you. It's never our turn." It was her policy to forgive my dad his lapses because wives did. He'd had that bad childhood too. Then a teacher who wore narrow ties, not because they were in style, but because he'd never bought the new wide ones, explained that impartiality is an ideal existing outside the toils of language. "A selection of facts is partial," he added. "Partial as in incomplete. Partial as in biased." He said I should go to a summer camp with students from 50 other schools, all between their junior and senior years, 2 weeks at a college 100 miles south. I'd stay in a dorm and take writing classes. I paused. I did the multiplication. I was a misfit at Spooner High. I'd be a misfit times 50. I said no. He rolled his eyes and didn't bring it up again. Months later, false spring again, and I was walking to my after-school job, stepping through slush, wearing a pastel dress with my winter coat flapping open. A southern breeze stirred branches flecked with buds doomed to freeze before they'd sprout again. My desire exceeded my portion. I couldn't face belabored spring, fickle summer, flashy autumn, immense winter, seasons moving and standing still. I fastened onto a word I'd read but didn't know how to pronounce, ennui. Suddenly I started running, twisting my ankles and my sandals with plastic fruits on the straps. I arrived at work early and phoned the school. The teacher was already gone. I tried his house, no answer. His wife ran the register at Rexall Drug, so I went across the street and told her I wanted to go to writer's camp, and I jotted this down, and she said, "Don't bother," she'd tell him. That July, when I arrived at writer's camp, my fears returned. Then I faked that I felt at ease, and I did. Some of the writers looked like heads. Some looked like cheerleaders and jocks. The cheerleaderish girls whispered that two girls looked like sluts, but I could tell the slutty-looking girls were just shy from the same small town and painted each other's eyeliner on too thick. I was nice to the eyeliner girls, to the cheerleader girls, and to a girl who looked like Carole King and quoted the Tao Te Ching. I also made friends with a boy named Michael, who signed his essays and poems. As days flicked by, a boy from Fond du Lac stared at me across a crowded room. Rodney, I noted, disloyal. An alternate future. Right before the last day, Chuck and I sat on a bench, hands touching. You shouldn't have sex. It was okay if you did with the man you'd marry, because you'd die having had sex with just him. I stopped him as Jane Eyre stopped her wedding. Except I'm candid. Talking to until after you've divulged. Instead of saying I was practically, but I'd plan to marry soon, I added quickly. I considered telling him I was Saturn and found the safest way forward. But if I lived somewhere else, I'd be so perfect and we'd meet at college in 18 months. But he looked frightened and hurt. That night, my parents arrived to drive me home. They'd been confused by the whole episode. Grammar, best football playing, not best use of figurative language. Gates, one after another hanging above me as we passed through the chute toward to the farmhouse where I'd helped his mother make casseroles. I couldn't focus. One evening, he was waiting for me to come down, gotten married, had moved from our cabin back to town. My mother sat with lately, but my parents wanted a modern house, so they'd installed orange indoor-outdoor carpet. Downstairs, I could tell my mother was in deep conversation with Rodney. She said we would, as a girl, still deciding. That night, after dinner, and we should break up now, as I began 12th grade, he started crying, if he wanted, but he loved me, so he wouldn't. He'd lettered in wrestling, back and forth in the kitchen window. As I spoke, muscles in my neck, sorry. His hands tightened. He still didn't seem violent, just out of the dashboard as I rolled onto the floor. He landed on me. My mother had begun rapping on the truck window. One night, after snow fell, he waited on the TV but let me take home to put on my nightstand. And the class ring that had thrilled me, I opened the door and gave them to him. He threw them into the snow. My mother called me, shivering, talking to him. He slumped behind the steering wheel, under the halo ring, but didn't find it until the next day, guessing where it was by marching receiver into a random outlet. He called from bars, music clanging, and drunken called from the tops of telephone poles. He'd done this once or twice in the past when he'd be work cleats dug in deep and say something cheerful and sweet. But he phoned now to say and go mute, waiting for me to volunteer that the last week had been a mistake. My mother started intercepting calls. I'd hear her, gentle at first, eventually. We worried. The wind whipped faster up there. The sun had set. My sister's bridesmaid, and my sister told me, called her my name when he was drunk. Bored me. I was lonely in high school because I was lonely in high school to phone company potlucks or hanging out with Rodney V. Meadows' mother, once in portable saunas shaped like washing machines, our heads sticking out. Not how they shaped paragraphs. I dated a boy who went to community college, was tripping, or he'd read Rilke. I made a bong and shot in the tub, offended she'd walked in. She shook the baggie's contents over me. My unhappy, wandering grandmother's husband had a heart attack in their kitchen, and she ran out the door to attack. We went to the two-coffin funeral with the husband's God-fearing and ex-pew on the right. I sat behind my father and uncles, their shoulders. I understood for the first time that if someone you love dies, you have sadness, but love you missed like a bus that left the station a long time ago. You have said they came to celebrate my graduation. My mother bought me a typewriter for a gift. Hangover recovery, better than most subjects. There's a photo of me on myself trying to look like a flapper, wearing a brooch Rodney V. Meadows' mother gave tin, something Rodney V. Meadows' mother would never wear, and I was well. In the photo, my grandmother, who did once dress like a rural flapper, looks another farm boy already. I'd had sex hundreds of times, but you're too relaxed. You move your hips like an expert. I clarified sex with. In turn, I didn't understand him, that emotion had been acted who'd arrived for the summer, and I liked him less than the farm boy, but the tourist boy, I was dating the tourist boy, but in a town so small, people told the farm boy for me, you're going to college, we should call it quits. I started crying. He shook his head, embroidering dish towels and pillow slips, the green fields dotted with wild mustard. I said, I like you. He said, I like you, but that's not going to fix this. Stayed up late talking about Keats and Emily Dickinson, also compromise majors, and I'd been for a two-day orientation, dorms that full up, thinning on airy prospects, the other grinding through mud. Both were again, silenced, uneasy, missing my set of instructions, or I'd stay where I didn't fit, but I'd feel superior. Now which? Just like that. And I did, but I dropped out at Christmas. Then I moved to Colorado with a guy who was 15 years older than me and wanted an indie. Really easy on my mom, I'm sure. I was like 18. And I came back, and I was working at the Topper Cafe, and then I went, I did okay. And then I decided, after living on, so that I could teach at a two-year college and teach like 5-5, you know. Before I left town, I married this country western guy I barely knew, and took him with me, and he left me almost immediately. I knew, but I kept it a secret for a long time. And it turned out I was pretty good at school, actually. And but then I decided, since I was single, that I would get a PhD, a master's degree that I really doubled down on the cooking, ironing, cleaning, dusting, sewing. But now I was a divorcee at age like 24, which is a weird thing in itself. And when I did, I moved to the University of Utah. And the other thing, archival research with, it was 100 pages long, I definitely had like writer's block, and even, and the professors were like, this should be a monograph. And I was like, well, I moved to the University of Utah, and I'm only going to read a couple pages here. But as I did, myself to do a better job dating, okay? So, okay? If, for example, we could have gone back to my apartment and slipped off my shiny dress to do in Kansas, where you get into tried and true positions that take you to brief ecstasy. As he lasted, in time, I'd even be able to tell my date he needed to dry clean his sports. Dry cleaning sex, you know. But the sex was polite, never know. He left afterward because he had to teach folklore at a community college 50 miles away. And I also want to say, this is like Utah before the locking up, and my devout neighbor's wife came outside. Her husband wasn't with her. I saw he picked you up wearing a jacket and you had on that beautiful dress. Later I heard to drown it out. She said, God doesn't want us to go through our lives alone, no matter how hard, measuring detergent, setting some washers on hot with full agitation, others on warm, confusing, and I shut the last lid. Then an extreme sports guy, except off of the mountains and snow, asked me for help with his laundry. I was relieved settings and how to save money on dryers by taking lighter pieces out first. Same age, except I was getting a PhD. PhD, oh wow, he said. It had slowed him down, he said, as had his job teaching skiing in a suburb in Delaware. I said, your mother didn't teach you before you left home? He said, green as in greenhorn. The lesson will take when the pupil is ready. Party a few blocks away. The other woman in the PhD program had told the revelers she was requested a tent and winter sleeping bags, and I heard laughing, shouting. I should have stayed home and worked on a paper, but I'd been fretting about the folklore boyfriend. Why was it hard now? I had only an inkling that the eras, a slow shift in understanding what wooing and mating would be during a larger, not just upward, but away from familiar communities, where you date your neighbor's cousins. No wonder arranged marriages persist, I thought, but every time I, what did I have if not control? Just secondhand furniture, first went to the party and met my second husband. I didn't marry him that roommate. The department head had moved to Salt Lake City because of the, then her brother's college roommate followed him. So I woke up with a short guy who said, where he said how exhausting he found the parties he went to with his roommate, roommate's sister, and a nude red. I countered this by telling him how, in front of classmates, I said merchant, by first considering that claret, also French but drunk by the English, rhymes with the folklore boyfriend stopped by my apartment. I wanted to ask him, like more certainty, you have feelings for me. Spring, sunlight, poor light makeover, and a housekeeper. I'm deeply fond of you, he said. I, he said, love you. Love. I had a coffee date with my second husband, to the fact that we'd had sex once and not again. My indecision had ripple effects. who'd told Chet to choose, and he wouldn't until I did. I started to panic. Not that I had been dating, who was the department head's wife's best friend. I imagined the department head and had handed out flyers in my freshman English class about the university's counseling center. I made it right, I felt. When I got to the counselor's office with a big window, the wide-aged man, I assumed he was Mormon because of his double-knit slacks, the side-part hair, and courage conformity. I looked for the ridges of his sacred garment through his slacks. He'd be trained to counsel non-Mormons, too. I summarized my situation, department head's wife's best friend. I was confused, maybe lonely, though it was, but the graduate students moved in and out of each other's apartments every time. We settled the romance question fast and got back to work. The dating pool for non- The counselor scrawled on a notepad. He said, I'm referring you to a psychiatric grandmother. Was I schizophrenic, too? I did have fragmented things. Counsel sex addicts. I'd never heard the term. Most people carry stress through meaningless sexual contact. You might need inpatient birds chirping, bees buzzing, trees blooming, branches quivering. Hey, I've haunted the laundromat. I should have gotten your phone number. But I didn't ski. I said so out loud, apparently, because he laughed and said, cooking each other dinner. Months earlier, I might have given him my phone number. I'd be sitting in class with that toupee guy, also a guy I'd kissed just after I'd moved here. I said, I'm in a big mess in terms of my schedule. The PhD, it's all consuming. I'll stop there.